First thing I want to say is I'm going to have to cancel the office hours today because I just have this really nasty cold and I dragged myself in to give a lecture, but I'm going to go home right after the lecture. Can you hear me? Because I don't have as much voice as usual. So if you need to see me, you better try and grab me right after class. All right, what I'm going to do today is begin by trying to wrap up the whole story of the origins of the First World War and summarize the point of the last few lectures about the July crisis and then move on to the whole issue of the origins of the war in general. What's the point there? What's the basic lesson to be drawn from a study of the immediate origins of the war, general origins of the war? You get that point by reacting to arguments that people make, by trying to put your finger on what it was not. Basic point of the last few lectures is that the First World War is to be understood in political terms. The dynamics of the July crisis are to be understood in political terms. Political in two main senses here. Political as opposed to military, and political as opposed to moral. First, political as opposed to military. There's this whole body of thought which insists on the importance of the military system that was in place in 1914 as, in a sense, the fundamental cause of the war. You know, normally the kinds of conflicts that you had, political conflicts, you should have been able to work them out. But statesmen, once they crossed a certain threshold, statesmen were overwhelmed by these forces of an essentially military nature, which brought on a war that should have been avoided, could have been avoided if the military system had been different. And so we spent a lot of time analyzing the various arguments of that sort that were made. And the bottom line there was that those factors are not nearly as important, not nearly as decisive as people make out. It's not that they counted for nothing, right? And we saw how, if you want to understand German policy, the very climax of the crisis on July 30th, 1914, why the Germans did so little to follow through with the new course that they had adopted on the night of July 29th, July 30th, restraining Austria, trying to avoid a war. Why they did so little? Almost certainly is because they had reached the judgment that war was inevitable. And if war was inevitable, better sooner than later. And why they had reached that conclusion, which is a kind of a preventive war sort of argument, let it come. Yeah? Yeah, I agree with that. The Russian policy is deeply puzzling because it doesn't make military sense. The reason it doesn't make military sense at that point is that it was to Russia's interest to allow Austria to get embroiled with Serbia, right? To force the Austrians, or to wait until the Austrians had divided their forces so that, you know, half of the Austrian army was dealing with Serbia. And then, after Austria had moved against Serbia, which wouldn't be for another couple of weeks, the Russians were informed by the British, who had found out about this from the Austrians, right? Only then, you know, would you think the Russians would make this kind of move? And they didn't do that. They kind of jumped the gun for these kind of trivial military advantages. And then there's the second big puzzle about Russia is that didn't they know what the German strategy was? Didn't they know that it was the Germans had decided to wait for Russia to order the first mobilization as a way of portraying themselves as the victims and so on, and that this is a defensive war. Weren't they getting reports from their military attaché in Berlin about what German policy was, right? If they had understood what German policy was, it would have been crazy for them to play into Germany's hands like that. So I have to say that you know, this is almost 100 years ago. Here we are in 2010. We're talking about 1914. That's 96 years ago. We still don't know the answers to these questions, right? There's another big puzzle about Russia. I think it was on July 25th, they reached the decision. I mentioned this in the lecture on the Fisher thesis. They reached the decision to advise the Serbs not to resist an Austrian invasion, but instead to trust her fate to the judgment of the great powers. And then, like a couple of days later, it's like a switch gets thrown, and it's like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, as soon as we reach the conclusion the war is inevitable, you know, that the other side is not willing to talk, we're going to mobilize. And then the third reason that the whole business with Russia is very hard to understand is this is essentially a weak state. Even this war, the local war against Japan, had nearly brought down the state. There was this revolution in 1905. And people were worried about the prospect of a Russian revolution. The revolution of 1917 didn't just come from nowhere. There was this revolutionary movement in Russia. And so if you're worried about the fate of the regime, right, do you really want to plunge into a war of this sort, especially when you had a military incentive to put it off? Your power is on the rise. The ability of the Germans to implement the Schlieffen Plan is going to become increasingly problematic. Why have the war now? You know? It's like the reason all of these questions are important is that they bear on the central issue that we're concerned with in this class, which is, are these events, are these policies to be understood as rational, right? Are they, you know, here you have this whole waltz argument. It's the anarchic structure of international politics that creates incentives for states to behave in such a way that pushes them into conflict with each other, right? States that behave rationally, given the basic structure of the system and the imperatives that it creates, that's the basic problem, for Waltz. He says it's states behaving rationally that's what lies at the root of the problem. And then when you start looking at these things, you know, scratching below the surface, you see it doesn't make sense. That's Russia. A little later, I'm going to, you know, make that same sort of argument about Germany and Britain and France. This is rational. Is the coming of the First World War to be understood in rational terms, as rational responses to the sorts of problems that exist in an anarchic system? Right? So anyway, you have this basic point that the war is not to be understood in military terms as the product of the military system that's in place at the time, even though military factors came into play on both the German side and the Russian side, you know, and played a role in tipping the balance at the climax of the crisis. But they're not fundamental. This is you know, it's like 2 or 3% of the story. The bulk of the story is this political story. And the other thing, political as opposed to moral. Moral means you're making all these judgments. You know, who's right and who's wrong? The whole notion of aggression is a very morally laden concept, right? First World War, you know, people claim it was a war of German aggression. Germans are the aggressors, therefore the war has to be understood in moral terms. The basic problem of understanding war is a problem of figuring out who to point the finger at. Who to blame, right? Who's guilty, right? And the political view says that's wrong-headed. It's wrong-headed because these moral judgments, they're not strictly historical judgments anyway. You're bringing your own set of moral standards to bear. Plus, even with most people's moral standards, it's very hard to say who's responsible, who's the guilty party. Can you blame the Austrians for trying to preserve their own state? Or can you blame the Serbs for reaching for self-determination for the Southern Slavs? Right? Who's to say who's right and who's wrong? These clear-cut moral judgments become very problematic. You know, can you blame the Germans for behaving in such a way that that they were concerned about the survival of the last remaining great power ally in Europe, and thinking that, well, given the thrust of Russian policy, war is inevitable, and if war is inevitable, better sooner than later. Can you blame them for that? I mean, if in fact those who were, their honest conclusions, their honest analysis, that's an understandable analysis. On the other hand, can you blame the Russians for standing up for the independence of a small Slavic country in the Balkans, or for Britain and France for standing by their ally? And it's like, who's to say who's to blame? Right? So instead of that, we take this view. The conflict is to be understood as in political terms, as this kind of purely political clash over which you can't make those sorts of hard and fast moral judgments. You know, yeah, maybe no one wanted a war, but if the Austrians, supported by Germany, was determined to take the Serbs down a notch so that they wouldn't be able to pose a threat to the continued integrity of the Habsburg monarchy, you know, basically clip their wings, prevent them from supporting this terrorist movement. And if Russia and the Entente said, well, we don't want a war either, but we're willing to go to war rather than see Serbia crushed like that, well, so you could have a war that results basically from that political conflict. That's the July crisis. That's why I was talking about the last few lectures. But the war wasn't simply a product of the July crisis. It was the culmination of events that had been developing for many, many years, since it could start in 1871. Right? And when you look at that whole process, it's the same basic point. It's the culmination of a political process. You know, the political process has its own logic, its own internal dynamic. And that's what we've been doing in this whole part of the course, is trying to trace that logic, try and understand the logic underlying the course of events. And rather than just kind of review chronologically from 1871 on, we can go back the other way and start in 1914 and look back, trying to identify what that political process was. Because what was quite striking for our purposes is Russia's commitment to not just the defense of Serbia, but to underwriting a revisionist Serb policy, a policy which the Russians knew was ultimately directed against the territorial integrity of the Habsburg monarchy. You remember those quotations I read to you from Sazonov from 1912 and 1913. The key event here is Russia's sponsorship of the Balkan League, which was a league that was designed to conduct a war of aggression against Turkey. Turkey in Europe was to be carved up. Right? Russia sponsored the Balkan League. When Poincaré, I think he was French president by that point, visited St. Petersburg in 1912 and was shown the text of the Balkan League Treaty, he said, this carries within itself the seeds of a war, not just against Turkey, but against Austria as well. Right? And given that Germany, the most powerful country in Europe, is Austria's ally, what this meant was that the Russians were playing with fire. Right? Now, if you take this whole perspective of who's to blame and who's guilty and so on, you look at all these things and say, well, what this means is that Russia is guilty. Russia was responsible for the war. Right? But if you take the political perspective, it's like, well, it's not an accident that Russia was able to do this. Russia by herself could not stand up to Germany and Austria. Right? It would have been inconceivable for Russia to pursue that sort of policy. Russia was able to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans precisely because she had the support of the Western powers. Now, it was not the case, this is another one of these arguments you find in Waltz. It was not the case that the Western powers would simply by virtue of the fact that they had an agreement or an alliance with Russia, that they would support Russia no matter what. Right? This is, according to Waltz, that's the way alliances work. It's not true. Russia was able to exert a certain amount of leverage over the Western powers because she had a plausible option of defecting from their alliance. Right? Basically, they needed Russia more than Russia needed them. And that kind of put Russia in the driver's seat there. At the beginning, for example, of the Franco-Russian alliance, 1893-1894, right? The French, although weaker then than they were in 1914, they hadn't developed their entente with the British yet. The French were unwilling to contemplate going to war for the sake of Russia's ambitions in the Balkans. But by 1914, not just the French, but the British as well felt that they had to support Russia no matter what the rights and wrongs of the situation were. Remember what I told you about, this is a liberal government in Britain. And the bulk of the liberal press during the July 1914 crisis is sympathetic, not with Serbia, but with Austria. What Austria had to deal with the Serbs, the British themselves would never put up with anything like this, the argument ran. Okay? So it's not the fact of the alliance that makes Britain and France side with Russia. Right? There's a puzzle about alliances from a realist point of view. From a realist point of view, countries behave in accordance with their power political interests. It's their geopolitical interests that determine their policy. So why should alliances make any difference? If they have an interest in supporting you, they'll support you whether they have an alliance with you or not. If they don't have an interest in supporting you, they won't support you whether they have an alliance with you or not. So why should alliances make any difference? This is one of these big problems that some people, political science people concerned with the theory of alliances, they concern themselves with. At the very least, it's important to note that alliances don't work in this kind of rigid, mechanical way. Oh, we signed an alliance. Well, I guess we don't have any choice anymore. That's not the way these things work. Okay? Britain and France had become so dependent on Russia that they thought they had to support Russia no matter what. Right? And so then the question is, why did they become dependent on Russia? Again, these are political questions having to do with the dynamics of the political system. Why had they become dependent on Russia? Well, that had to do with their relations with Germany. They were dependent on Russia because their relations with Germany had gotten so bad. Germany had come to regard Britain as her principal adversary. Quite early on, by 1905 this was. This is why the German emperor was reaching out to the Tsar during the during that period in 1905, the whole Bjorko business and so on. Right? Britain is Germany's main adversary. Right? You know, this is one of these things that puts Russia in a very favorable bargaining position. It's competition for Russian favor. You see that also, the German efforts in 1910, the Potsdam Agreement in 1910. Russia is in a strong position diplomatically. That's why Russia could contemplate, you know, a forward policy. Again, it's a political argument. It's based on the assumption that there's a connection between how much power you have in the system, not just military power, but power in the sense of the whole web of alignments, whole web of relationships, and what you could hope to achieve politically. You know, when you're weak, you have to, you know, draw in your horns and take a very moderate stance. But when you're strong and when everyone else wants to be friends with you, well, then you can push forward. Right. So then we have, so this whole situation with Russia is very much linked to the deterioration of relations between Germany and the Western powers. That you know, the whole story from the Anglo-French Entente through the first Moroccan crisis to the second Moroccan crisis. And colored by such things as the Anglo-German naval race, you know, Germany's imperial aspirations, Germany's desire to replace Britain as the world's premier imperial power. Okay. The worse relations are between Germany and the West, the better off Russia's going to be. Okay. And the more dependent Britain and France are going to be on Russia. You know? And this is why, once you start, you know, once you begin to come to the conclusion that a war is inevitable, you want to make sure that you have as many allies as possible in that war. You know, Britain and France, they want to make sure, if war is inevitable, that Russia's going to be an ally of theirs. They don't want to have to deal with Germany on their own. They want to make sure that Germany has to fight a two-front war, has to divide her forces so that they could deal with the German threat more easily. Okay? They can't, or they feel they can't, hold off Germany on their own. Oh, well, one of the reasons for this is that Britain doesn't have a large land army. Britain is essentially a naval power. The British develop a very large land army in the course of the war, but they don't maintain a large force in being in northern France, meaning that France herself is too weak to hold the Germans at bay, or at least that was the assumption, without another strong continental ally. Right. Right. So, you know, and you see this kind of dynamic all the time in international politics. It's like, Another major example during the Cold War is the falling out between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China put the United States in a very strong position without the United States having to lift a finger to do that. And it's like an automatic byproduct of it, pretty much. Right. So Britain and France, as this notion takes hold that showdown with Germany is probably inevitable, the idea begins to develop in their minds, well, if that's the case, we better make sure that the war breaks out over some eastern issue rather than, say, over Morocco. If it breaks out over some western issue, Russia may stand aside. If it breaks out over an issue that Russia has a direct interest in, or Russia calls the shots, then we'll at least be sure of having Russia's an ally. Right? And it's only because they're not absolutely certain which way Russia would go that they make that kind of argument. So then we have the problem, going back yet further, of trying to understand the deterioration of relations between Germany on the one hand and Britain and France on the other. Right? And again, the issue is this to be understood in rational terms? You know, the whole Waltz theory, anarchic structure of international politics forces states to, you know, think in power political terms to improve their power political position and so on. Right? And what you're struck by as you look at this stuff in greater detail is the fact that the policies of those three countries do not make sense in power political. Most strikingly in the case of Germany. here's Germany. Yes, Germany has, you know, grandiose aspirations. Wants to become one of the world's premier imperial powers. In fact, displace Britain in that role, ultimately. But Germany isn't strong enough by herself to simply lay down the law to the rest of Europe. Germany might be the strongest country, but it's not a hegemonic power. Germany has to worry about the attitude of all the other countries in Europe. Even if Germany had a purely defensive policy, it would not have made sense for Germany to alienate the three next most important powers of Europe all at the same time. Not just France with Alsace-Lorraine and Russia by basically siding with Austria on the whole issue of an expansion of Russian power in the Balkans, but Britain as well over these imperial, naval, and colonial issues, right? It's elementary. You would not want to create a coalition of your most power, you know, of all the most powerful countries in Europe against you. Right? You would want to isolate them. You would want to deal, you know, it's Bismarck did, deal with them one by one. Yet the Germans behave in this way that leads to the creation of the Triple Entente. Doesn't make sense. That wouldn't make sense if Germany had a purely defensive policy, but given that Germany has these grandiose ambitions, it makes much less sense, because you need more power to effect change in the status quo than simply to keep things as they are. Germany's weaker under William II than she had been under Bismarck. Because under Bismarck, you know, Bismarck had, you know, dominated the system. You know, he was able to manipulate the system so that, you know, Germany would have decent relations with all the other major powers of Europe except for France. Right? Under William II, Germany had alienated not just France, but Russia and Britain as well. Doesn't make sense, right? Can't be understood in rational terms. Wasn't a rational response to the to the basic Waltzian problem of the anarchic structure of international politics. But it doesn't stop there because you say, well, that's the Germans. What do you expect from the Germans? They don't have any political sense. It's like, it's not just Germany. It's like, you look at Britain and France, it's the same sort of story. The policies that they pursued did not make sense in power political terms. It was not to their interest. Why was it not to their interest? Because it made them dependent on Russia. The whole trick of policy from the standpoint of you know, old-fashioned realists, balance of power thinkers, the kind of philosophy which we saw dominant at the Congress of Vienna in 1814, 1815, balance of power philosophies, you don't want to burn your bridges with anybody unless you absolutely have to, because you would want Germany to serve as a counterweight to Russia. You would want relatively decent relations with Germany so Russia couldn't blackmail you if you're Britain. You would want Germany to be a counterweight to Russia, Russia to be a counterweight to Germany. You want to hold the balance between those two. Because if either of them, you know, became a cipher, you know, counted for nothing, totally collapsed, then you have this huge colossus on your border to deal with, and your problem would become unmanageable. All right? But instead, you have antagonism develops, especially between Britain and Germany, but also between France and Germany as well. You find the humiliation of your adversary becoming a pleasant prospect, the alienation of your adversary becoming kind of desirable, frustrating your adversary's ambitions. Right? Germany wants to be an imperial power. Well, we'll show that. We're gonna really stick it to them and prevent them from getting anything. What's the effect of that? Not just that it makes you dependent on Russia, but it also causes the Germans to get the sense that the system that they're living in has no legitimacy. that that no one is taking due account of their interests, that they are not getting anything from it. This is not a the sort of situation you would want to have. You know, the basic philosophy at the Congress of Vienna was you want everyone to have a sense for the basic legitimacy of the system, so that no one is tempted to revolt against it. This is, and you do detect this emotional overtone in relations between Germany and the West during this period. In other words, emotional and not rational. It's like you read the Crow Memorandum, you saw, you know, the comparison of Germany is with a professional blackmailer, extortionist. Everyone else will pay off, right? We want to ensconce ourselves in Egypt, so we'll buy off the French by making a deal with them over Morocco. We'll buy off, you know, the Italians and so on. Everyone else will buy off, but not Germany. When Germany asks for the same sort of thing, well, Germany's a blackmailer, right? Something is going on there, right? That's not rational power political terms, right? So all this stuff bears very directly on this claim that in an anarchic system, there's no overarching authority, and countries have to be concerned, above all, with their power political interest, their power political position. That's a sort of arrangement in which a rational adjustment to that situation forces states onto a collision course with each other. It's kind of almost exactly the opposite, right? It's the failure to approach policy in those cold, calculating, rational terms that lay at the root of the problem. Yeah.
How is the antagonism between Germany and France different?
Under Bismarck, when France was isolated, French behavior was impeccable. You couldn't criticize the French for doing anything. Well, it's because they're weak, right? By the eve of the war, they have this alliance with Russia, they have this entente with Britain, they're part of this coalition of three. Remember, in the Europe of five great powers, the key thing is to be one of three. And now we could stick it to the Germans. Right? First Moroccan crisis, look how, you know, the Germans were dealt with then. Second Moroccan crisis, you know, this whole notion of, you know, now that we're strong, we could kind of show the Germans. This is, you get emotional satisfaction from these things. You know, kicking an adversary when they're weak. It's like, you see this kind of thing today going on, by the way, United States-Russian relations. That's quite extraordinary. People don't see anything wrong with this. You know, you remember that Salisbury thing that we read about 1871? Salisbury says, you know, this is crazy. Is that the Germans get satisfaction from the mortification of France? Like, they're paying a huge price for this. When you make people an enemy of yours, you pay a huge price. You have an incentive to maintain tolerable relations with these other countries. So the French policy, to my mind, does not make sense. It's like, well, it leads to the First World War, which is the greatest catastrophe in modern French history by far. All right. So all of this stuff, this basic set of points relates very directly to these kind of core issues of international relations theory, this whole question of realism and whether realist policy is good or bad, whether states behaving rationally in a system based on power. That rational behavior is the source of armed conflict. It has a very direct bearing. And not just in the run-up to the war, but in the war itself. You see these same basic points. The war itself. You all know about the First World War. It's like, everyone goes in with its belief in the power of the offensive. Everyone has these offense-oriented war plans. Germans have the Schlieffen plan. They implement the Schlieffen plan. It doesn't succeed. They don't knock France out of the war. And instead of a rapid military decision based on rapid offensive military operations, instead of that, the front, more in the west than in the east, but basically the fronts during the First World War stabilize. Each side digs itself in. Huge line of trenches running throughout northern France from the German border to the channel. And they dig themselves in these trenches and protect themselves with machine guns and all sorts of fortifications. And the war is—it's a stalemate, in the West. It's like there are all these pushes. People rise up out of the trenches and try and get land at the expense of the enemy, and then just mowed down by machine gun fire. It's just it turns out people thought that the offense would be dominant. It turns out that World War I showed that the defense was dominant. That earthworks and machine guns could give armies the ability to kind of frustrate offensive military operations on the part of their adversaries. That's the First World War. Four years of that, pretty much, until the very end. What should have been the political consequences of that if people had been rational, if people had viewed this whole set of problems in realist terms? And realist terms means making sure that your political objectives are in sync with your military capabilities. You would have thought that there would have been a compromise peace, wouldn't you? There's an important line of argument associated with a scholar named Blaney. First name was Jeffrey Blaney, and he wrote a book called The Causes of War. And his whole argument is that war breaks out because of a misunderstanding about what the balance of power actually is. Each side thinks it's going to win, but you can't have both sides winning. If countries have the same understanding for what the military balance is, they'll adjust their foreign policies accordingly, and they'll reach a political agreement which would head off the war. It's a very nice argument, and basically a political scientist, Blaney was a historian, a political scientist named James Fearon kind of carried the ball and formalized this and added a number of things, drawing on economic theory. And the whole point of this line of argument is that war has a political function. Its political function is to reveal information. In this case, information about what the balance of power is. Right? And that's why you have peace. Because war reveals this, what the true balance of power is. States adjust their policies accordingly. They make peace. Right? The difference about what the balance of power is that had been responsible for the war in the first place, those differences get cleared up by the course of events. In the case of the First World War, the war reveals that these two blocks are of approximately equal power. It's a military stalemate. Therefore, we should have a compromise peace. status quo ante. You know, forget about complete victory, total victory. Yeah. And in fact, it's sometimes said that Schlieffen himself, the Schlieffen plan was a bit of a gamble. He said himself, well, if it doesn't succeed, then we have to kind of make a big effort to reach a negotiated peace, compromise peace. Right? Forget about total victory. And that whole line of thinking that there should be a connection between your political objectives and your military capabilities, that these things should be in sync with each other, that's very much in line with traditional realist thought. It's associated, above all, with the great Prussian theorist of war, Karl von Clausewitz. The whole essence of the Clausewitzian philosophy was that was the kind of deep interconnectedness between the political sphere and the military sphere, both as something that existed in the real world and something that should exist, probably to an even greater extent. The whole and Clausewitz, he basically had this whole argument about how things worked in the military sphere just by itself. There was this tendency for war to become absolute, for all of the constraints to be thrown off, and for the level of violence to just escalate. Right? And then Clausewitz said, but it's not as simple as that, because war doesn't just exist as an isolated phenomenon. It's not like a natural disaster. Wars are conducted for political purposes. That's what gives them their meaning. Right? And he saw this kind of natural interplay between the military side and the political side, between the tendency of war to become absolute, for the level of violence to increase, and for the need to have political control over the instruments of violence, so as to make sure that they served political objectives, right? And that tension between the political and the military, that was the heart of conflict, according to Clausewitz. He has this wonderful sense. He says, war has its own grammar, but not its own logic. And the logic had to be supplied from the outside, but through political direction. Right? Right? This is what makes the First World War such a puzzle. Right? Yeah? Rational statesmen, statesmen schooled in the old balance of power philosophy, schooled in the thinking of Clausewitz and so on, the kind of core tradition of Western realist thought, they would have said, okay, well, it's a military stalemate. Instead of allowing the bloodletting to continue, we see what relative power is. We'll simply make a peace that corresponds to that reality. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. That's the great puzzle of the First World. The fires rage until they burn themselves out. That's that quote from Churchill that Brody cites in that thing that you're reading this week. Now, I don't know how many of you know about Bernard Brody. He next to Thomas Schelling is the second. Well, he and Schelling are the two great strategic thinkers of the nuclear age. And Brody actually was a professor here at UCLA. And he wrote this book called Strategy in the Missile Age. And he was very interested. You know, his goal was to get people to understand how the body of thought that had developed in the pre-nuclear period was still relevant to approaching nuclear issues. And in particular, this whole issue of the relationship between military means and political goals, which he felt had been lost sight of. That when people talked about nuclear strategy, they lost sight of the fact that a war was being conducted for political reasons. These war plans became kind of ends in themselves. And he says, this kind of thing is a disaster. This that way of looking at things is a disaster. And to underscore that argument, he talked a lot about World War I and how crazy it was. Right? Instead of a compromise peace, they just go on fighting. Because they're not thinking in political terms. The aim was to win. The goal is to win. So that's kind of crazy. The goal is to win. Right? It should be a political objective. As long as the goal is to win, you're not going to have peace. Right? Well, in fact, the whole issue is a little bit more complex than that. Because there are reasons why none of these governments went for compromise peace. Right? In the case of Germany had very ambitious war aims. Germany's war aims laid out very early in the war amounted to all kinds of changes which would have resulted in German hegemony in Europe. Further annexations, for example, at the expense of France, transformation of Belgium into essentially German fiefdom, that sort of thing. Okay, but Germany was not the only country whose policy had changed in that direction. You find France wanting not just to get back Alsace-Lorraine, but also to make annexations in the German Rhineland. You find Russia wanting to take advantage of the war to take over the Turkish Straits. Increasingly, the notion in Britain was that the whole German imperial regime had to be brought down. Okay. What's going on there? It's not just the German phenomenon again. It's a general European phenomenon. Okay. Well, the argument was when people talked about annexation, they said, "Well, we need guarantees. Look how awful this war is. Obviously, it's not our fault. It's because the enemy is so bad. That's why we have the war." You know, the worse it is, the less people are willing to say that they had any share in the of the responsibility for causing it. It's all the enemy. The enemy is a criminal. Well, we have to make sure that the enemy is unable to repeat his crimes. We need guarantees. Well, guarantees was like its code term for annexations. Plus, as the war went on, and as it became clear that the two sides were almost equally matched, what that meant was that anything that could tip the balance would be of extraordinary importance. And one of the most important things was morale. And didn't want to kind of encourage defeatism on the part of your own people for fear of what the military consequences of that would be by talking in terms of the need for a compromise peace, right? And the people were making all these sacrifices, so you had to hold up to them all these arguments about why these sacrifices were worth making. And the argument was, oh, it's going to lead to this radically new world, but if you're just going to go back to the status quo ante, how could you make that kind of argument? Right. So everyone becomes kind of trapped by the dynamics here. Trapped by the dynamics. During peacetime, you know, people may have, you know, ambitious goals, but those goals are counterbalanced by the desire to avoid war. Well, once a war breaks out, you don't have that counterbalance anymore. So these aspirations become unleashed. Right? But also there's this intellective element here. The decline of that balance of power tradition, the decline of the kind of thinking is sort of the beginning of the 19th century. All right, what does all this mean? It means the war goes on. And that you're not going to have a political settlement, a negotiated settlement. It means that if there's going to be a decision, it's going to be reached on the battlefield. And so the focus of the war, what determines the dynamics of the war, are all these things that can affect the outcome of the military struggle. Any weapon seems that it might be decisive militarily, well, that weapon is going to become extremely attractive. So you have poison gas. and you have the development of the tank, and you have the German development of the submarine to kind of build, bring the British to their knees. And not just in the military sphere, but also in the diplomatic sphere, because maybe bringing another power into the war would play a key role. So you have all this maneuvering to kind of court the neutrals. So Italy, even though Italy was a Triple Alliance ally of Germany and Austria, Italy comes into the war on the side of the Entente in 1915, having been bribed by all these promises of territorial gains. And then Romania comes into the war on the side of the Entente in 1960. And Bulgaria and Turkey come into the war on the side of the Central Powers, right? But there's one big neutral whose entry into the war really will be decisive. And that's the United States of America. And American entry into the war in 1917 is what basically determines the outcome of the conflict. So that's what I'll talk about next time, America's entry into the First World War, April 1917.